Official session moderator, Jeffrey Norcross, who's joining us from EPA Region 1 in the Office of Site Remediation and Restoration. Jeff, whenever you're ready to begin, please do.
Okay, thanks, Jean. Welcome, everybody. Again, my name is Jeff Norcross, and I'm a member of EPA Region 1's RCRA lead region team. Thank you for participating in today's Expert Brown Bag webinar on EPA's Hazardous Waste Generator Improvements Rule. During today's session, our presenters will provide information and answer questions about the recently overhauled hazardous waste generator regulations under RCRA. The changes, which become effective on May 30, 2017, are a result of EPA's experience in implementing and evaluating the hazardous waste generator program over the last 30 years, as well as a response to concerns and issues identified by states and the regulated community. As Jean stated, there will be time for questions at the end of the session. Feel free to type them in on the screen as we go along. At this time, I'd like to introduce today's presenters, Kathy Lett and Mary Beth Sheridan. Kathy and Mary Beth both work in EPA's Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. Kathy has worked at EPA for 17 years, primarily on hazardous waste recycling and generator issues, as well as on energy conservation and wastewater management. Recently, Kathy has worked on the definition of solid waste rulemaking and the hazardous waste generator improvements. She holds a BA in comparative literature from Hamilton College in Clinton, New York. Mary Beth has worked at EPA since 1997, primarily on hazardous waste recycling and generation. Before coming to EPA, she worked as an environmental consultant, a technical writer for the Hazardous Waste Consultant, and an information specialist for EPA's RCRA Superfund hotline. Mary Beth graduated from St. Lawrence University with a double major in environmental studies and biology, and has a master's degree in environmental policy and management from the University of Denver. At this time, I'd like to turn things over to Kathy and Mary Beth. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Jeff. Hi, this is Kathy Lett. Just gonna wait for the presentation to come up. We already talked a little bit about questions. I do want to make one further point about the questions, is that when you submit your question, it's very useful to us if you make the context of the question clear, because we're going to be addressing them after covering all the topics. So if you can just make it clear to us what topic you are referring to in your question, then it will be easier for us to get you an answer. This is a brief overview of what we're going to cover today. As you can tell, we have a lot on our agenda. We're going to start very briefly with a little bit of background and context, but as you guys are RCRA experts, we're not going to talk about that too much. And then we're just going to run through the revised provisions. We're generally approaching the order of the provisions in the presentation in the order that the generator might encounter them when going through the regulations and managing hazardous waste as it goes through their process. And I also want to point out that the presentation, it focuses on the new changes in the rule that was published last November, and it's not intended to cover the whole generator program. As I said, we're just going to breeze through most of these slides. RCRA is designed to protect human health and the environment from waste disposal. We're talking about hazardous waste and the generator regulations for those wastes. I do want to point out one thing on this slide, which is that the rule does rename the category that federally has been known as conditionally exempt small quantity generators. We're renaming that to very small quantity generators, which is something that we think better explains what the category is, and we know that some of the states have already done that. But we aren't changing anything about what the sizes of the category are. We just did that renaming. As far as the history of the rule, the changes, there are about 60 plus substantive changes of various degrees in the rule, and almost all of them come from outreach and public comments and talking to the states and various different program evaluations that we have done to try to improve the generator program. And I'm not going to go through them all, but I do want to thank anybody who participated in that in any way. We really relied on state expertise and the folks in our regions on a lot of these items, and I want to take this opportunity to thank you for that because it helped us make a better rule. This is some information about the public comment on the proposal. We got over 230 comments. They were generally very helpful, and they came from all different sectors, including the states and local governments. And we did our best to incorporate those as we went final. We were published in November. The effective date, as was mentioned already, is May 30th. I know there have been a lot of questions about whether this date is changing for any reason. As far as we know, we're still May 30th. We were not delayed with the 30 EPA rules that got their effective date delays. That didn't affect us. There has been litigation filed on the lawsuit, and that is on the rule, and that is proceeding, but that has not impacted our effective date. The rule will go into effect in Iowa and Alaska, the territories and tribal lands on that effective date. We know there are a couple of states also going to effect at that time. And I do want to take this opportunity to mention, if you don't know, we are heading here a users group for states and regions that are implementing the rule. We're calling it the Generator Rule Users Group. It's just an opportunity to have regular conversations about the rule, about any challenges that states are facing in implementation, or questions that you have, or suggestions for guidance that we should put out here. And that currently we're meeting every 2 weeks. We're hoping to go to once a month. But if you're interested and you haven't heard about it yet and you want to be involved, you can email me about that. That's let.cathy@epa.gov. My email address is at the end of these slides. So just email me. We'd be happy to have you. You don't have to be going into effect right away. Anyone is welcome. Well, any state is welcome and region. As far as the adoption questions, we are seeing questions about what is more stringent in the final rule, what is less stringent. You may be familiar, if you do state adoption, with Wayne Ropey. He has put together some checklists already on this for adoption purposes, but this is just a summary of which provisions are more stringent and which are less. There are quite a few provisions in the rule that we are considering equally stringent, including clarifications of the regs and the reorganization. But these are the ones that are more and less stringent. And this is just for people who don't have a sense of how many generators we're talking about. This is the size of the generator universe. These are the numbers we use in our economic analysis for the rulemaking. And we know that in one way or another, we're probably affecting each of these generators with the changes. For the VSQGs, it's just giving them more options. But we do know that there's quite a few folks out there who are being affected by the rule. Okay. The goals of the rule were reorganizing the regulations to make them more user-friendly, providing some greater flexibility to the generators in some areas, also closing some gaps, and making things more clear in general. I'm going to start with briefly covering the reorganization. We have heard over the years that the structure of the federal regs is quite hard to follow, particularly 262.34, which has the accumulation standards for the generators. And it alternates between large and small quantity generators, and it also includes what you have to do in a satellite accumulation area, just because those regulations were just added into 34 as they were developed over the years. So what we did is we reorganized the regulations for a more logical structure, and it moves the requirements for VSQGs and counting out of 261.5 and puts them into 262. Counting goes into 262.13. The VSQG provisions go into 14. And then we gave each subsequent section, each subsequent category, its own section of the regs. So satellite accumulation goes into 15, the SQGs go into 16, and the LQGs go into 17. We also made quite a few conforming changes to account for those revisions. So we do think that these changes are going to make it a lot easier for the generators to figure out what they need to do. And it's also going to more easily absorb any future changes to these regulations. So hopefully not for a while. We do know that some states have already made revisions along these lines, and but that some might have some challenges, and we are working on ways to help with that federally. And if you want to, we have a checklist in the regulations, a crosswalk that says where things moved, and we know that we really think that this is going to make things easier for the generators and for everyone who's new to RCRA in the future. Okay, so we're going to go through the presentation as the generator goes through the regulations, maybe if they're first time generating hazardous waste, and they need to start with a hazardous waste determination. So Mary Beth is going to talk about that.
Okay, so we're on slide 17. And as you, most of you probably are familiar with, this is, as Kathy said, the entry point into RCRA is you first have to determine if you're generating a hazardous waste. So it's an existing section, 262.11, but we did make a number of we added a number of clarifications to it to hopefully help with the problem, which we had found when we did earlier work. Before we did the rulemaking, we did a couple program evaluations, and one of them looked at the compliance of generators with making hazardous waste determinations and found that this was a fairly high area of noncompliance. And it's important because if you fail to make an accurate hazardous waste determination at the very beginning, then you're not going to be managing your waste properly. And some of the reasons were, you know, they weren't even aware of RCRA, to not understanding how RCRA worked. So we're hoping that some of the clarifications can help. As some of you may know, we did propose that generators also document where they looked at their materials, their waste, and determined they were not hazardous. We did propose that, but we got a lot of adverse comment that that was basically going too far. There was a lot of burden. It would be a lot of burden, especially on facilities with a number of waste streams like college and university labs and some other, the retail sector, et cetera. So we're not requiring that, but we do continue to recommend it as a best management practice. So some of the clarifications we did make on the next slide are, first, we actually put in the regulations that the waste determination must be accurate. It has to be made at the point of generation, which we've said in guidance and preamble all along, but we put it right in the regulations. And we also added that they would have to reevaluate if at any time during the course of managing it, it would potentially exhibit a hazardous waste characteristic. You know, those situations are fairly rare, but they do happen. And one example is biphasic solvents, where they can separate into two layers, and one layer may be ignitable, and it wasn't ignitable when it was combined with water. So, you know, the generator needs to understand enough about their waste stream to know if it could potentially change and become hazardous. And then they would need to manage it appropriately. We also explained more fully in the regulations how generators can use generator knowledge and tests in making hazardous waste determinations. And we talked about, in the preamble, we talked a lot about what tests are determinative and which tests may not be determinative, but they can be useful in providing that generator knowledge. Then we explained also how a generator should be evaluating a little more in the completely in the regulations how they should look at their waste for the hazardous waste characteristics. And then finally, we moved or copied the waste determination record keeping requirements from 26240C and also put them in 26211. So you have all of the information about hazardous waste determinations in one place. And once again, that record keeping is for the hazardous waste determinations. We did not finalize the requirement to document non-hazardous waste determinations. Okay, now Kathy is going to talk about hazardous waste counting.
So after a waste determination, the generator has to count its hazardous waste to figure out if it's a VSQG, an SQG, or an LQG. So there was a little bit of information in the old regs about counting, mainly a couple of paragraphs in 261.5, which listed things that didn't have to be counted. So what we decided to do is we added a new section, 262.13. We drew from those sections in 261.5. We've included them here in 262.13. But we also added a process for a generator to determine its generator category. And we talk about that both for generators that just have non-acute hazardous waste or just have acute hazardous waste, and also generators that have both acute and non-acute hazardous waste or have, you know, acute waste and cleanup waste from a spill of acute waste. So we talk about how they can determine their generator category. In addition, we included a table in the regulations that has the same information about the large quantity generators as the definitions. I think I skipped over mentioning earlier that we codified the definitions for the categories in 260.10. This is the same information as we have there, but it shows you the scenarios for being each category of waste. So a large quantity generator, you know, the three categories are acute hazardous waste, non-acute hazardous waste, and residues from a cleanup of acute waste. If a large quantity generator goes over the threshold in any of those three categories, then it's a large quantity generator. If you're below the threshold for acute hazardous waste and for cleanups, and you generate more than 100 and 1,000 kilograms of non-acute hazardous waste, then you're a small quantity generator, and if you're below the threshold for all, you're a very small quantity generator. And again, this isn't new information, but it wasn't laid out before in the regulations like this. It was more of a wild goose chase to find it. The next section of the regulations after counting is 262.14, which is where you're going to find your regulations for very small quantity generators. Again, most of this was moved from 261.5 as part of the reorganization. VSQGs have very limited requirements under RCRA, and we didn't change that in this new rule, but we did add two new sets of provisions that add flexibility into the regulations for the generators who are normally in this category. I'm going to start with episodic generation, which affects VSQGs and also SQGs. So the problem with the traditional RCRA regulations is that these smaller generators, they occasionally have an event, which we call an episodic event in the regulations, where they generate more than their limit for their category in a month. And it could be something that's planned, like a tank cleanout, or it could be an unplanned event like upset conditions or a spill or a storm. And the upshot is that for that short period, the regulations would require the VSQG or the SQG to comply with, let's say, LQG regs for just a short period until they deal with that that higher generation amount. And then they would go back to their regular category. So we've heard many times that this is a real challenge for the smaller generators, and the revisions are meant to address that. So what we finalized was basically that the generator can maintain their existing category provided that they comply with a streamlined set of requirements. The generator can have one event per calendar year, and then they have the ability to petition for a second event. If the first event is planned, the second event that they petition for would have to be unplanned, or vice versa. So they can't have two planned events or two unplanned events in a year. There's a notification requirement at least 30 days prior to a planned event. If the event is unplanned, that's revised to be within 72 hours after it occurs. And then they have to conclude the episodic event within 60 days, and that includes getting the waste off-site. Under episodic generation, the waste has to be manifested and sent to a TSDF or a RCRA, other RCRA-designated facility. I do want to point out that the episodic event begins on the first day that the waste is generated, and that these requirements are for discrete events, not just for accidentally going over generation limits in the course of normal production. As far as management standards, the streamlined requirements for VSQGs are obtaining a RCRA ID, a EPA ID number, using the manifest and the hazardous waste transporter to send the episodic waste to a TSDF or recycler, managing the episodic waste in a manner that minimizes the possibility of an accident or release. There's a labeling requirement, and they have to identify an emergency coordinator in their notification, and then maintaining some records. SQGs have requirements that are basically maintaining the records associated with the episodic event, and then also complying with their existing SQG regulations. So they already have to have an ID number and manifest and all that. So they are going to comply with their standard requirements and then keep records. We also have another flexibility of the SQG consolidation, and Mary Beth is going to talk about that.
Okay, now we're on slide 25, and this is a provision that we've been asked about for years. Companies that have multiple facilities would like to, some of which are VSQGs, they would like to be able to consolidate the waste, and for them, it's for more efficient shipping. It helps reduce their liability overall, and they just, it's the thing they want to do. It wasn't allowed under the previous regulations because an LQG wasn't a designated facility. So we think it's the right thing to do, too, because in the end, the waste will now be sent to a RCRA-designated facility, so it's the best environmental outcome. So the final provision, what we decided was to allow it at the LQG if the LQG and the VSQG are under the control of the same person. Person is defined in RCRA as under 260.10, and control means the power to direct policies at the facility. So basically these are the same, they're owned and operated by the same person. If that's the case, then the VSQG, they have very limited requirements. They just have to mark and label their containers with the words hazardous waste and the hazards, which I'll go in over that requirement in a couple more slides. But then the LQG has a few more things they have to do. They have to notify using the site ID form that they're participating in this activity, and then they're going to fill in the addendum to the site ID form, they're going to list the VSQGs that are participating as well. They have to keep records for each shipment, but those records can be standard business records, bill of lading, etc. They do not have to be the manifest. And then once the waste gets to the LQG, they have to ensure that they have to treat it as they would their own LQG hazardous waste. So that means getting it off-site in 90 days and getting it to a RCRA-designated facility, either a TSDF or a recycler. And then the last condition that the LQG would do is they will report that waste from the VSQG that they received in their biennial report. And we're planning to have a separate source code, so we'll be able to see which facilities are using this and how much waste is being consolidated. And with the idea that in the future we may expand this provision if it proves to be useful and successful, we may look at doing either allowing consolidation in SQG or maybe going to intercompany. Okay. So as I mentioned, I was going to talk about marking and labeling. So we changed the marking and labeling throughout the whole hazardous waste regulations. Previously, under RCRA regulations, generators did not have to, they had to use the words hazardous waste, but they didn't have to indicate the hazards of the hazardous waste that was being accumulated. And we think this was a gap in the regulations and could result in, you know, a problem with risk communication. So it could impact workers, waste handlers, emergency responders, and visitors. So we made a change, and this applies throughout. So it starts at satellite accumulation areas and the generator central accumulation areas. It goes throughout the regulation. So transfer facilities have to keep the hazards, and then even generator container and tank storage areas at TSDF have to comply with this. So how do you comply with the new requirement? So we decided to give flexibility, and there's a number of already established methods that you can use to show the hazards. You can do DOT hazard communication, which is shown, those are at the bottom of the slide. You can use an OSHA hazard statement or pictogram. The NFPA labels are also acceptable, or you can even just use the RCRA characteristic, the wording of the characteristic, for example, ignitable or toxic. And for containment buildings, we said the generator can keep this information in logs or records near the accumulation unit. And we did not finalize that you had to identify the contents of the container. We got a lot of feedback that, you know, that was just too much to put on labels if you did the hazards and the contents and the words hazardous waste. So we decided that the hazards were most important. Another issue we addressed in marking and labeling was that generators didn't always identify the specific hazardous waste codes. And as a result, receiving TSDFs might not know how to treat the waste to meet LDR. So this is only applies at the point it's being sent off-site to a TSDF. That's when the generators have to add the applicable RCRA waste code. Or they could use, we did say, a barcode system. As long as you can associate that waste code with that container using the barcode, then that would satisfy this requirement. Okay, as Kathy mentioned, we're kind of marching through the regulations as a generator would. So the next set is 262.15 is where we put the satellite accumulation area regulations. And we made a number of clarifications. So these already existed in the regulations, but we tried to, you know, answer some of the, most of these were in guidance before this final rule, so we decided we needed, you know, to put them in the regulations. So one, the first one is that hazardous waste can't be mixed or put in a container that held hazardous waste that are incompatible. And that's a standard that already applied at the central accumulation area, but we just extended it to the satellite accumulation area. We also put in the regulations some provisions for allowing containers to remain open temporarily, but only under limited circumstances where it's necessary for safe operations. For example, if you're working in and the hazardous waste is so, it's at a temperature that's so hot that explosive gases would build up, then you can leave the top open until it cools. But then once it's cooled down enough that it's safe, the top needs to be closed. We also provided some clarification about how much weight could be in the satellite accumulation in addition to the volume for acute hazardous waste. So once it reaches that level, it needs to be moved to the central accumulation area. So previously we only had the volume, but now we also included weight. We clarified that 3 days, which is how long you have to move it once it reaches the limit, is 3 consecutive calendar days. And then we rescinded a memo that was very specific to reactive waste that allowed them to be stored away from the point of generation, basically away from the satellite accumulation area, and we decided that that wasn't really a good idea. And if it was so reactive that it needed to be stored away from the point of generation, then it should really go directly to the central accumulation area. And then finally, we made marking and labeling, as I mentioned, consistent throughout the regulation. So now in the satellite area, you also will need to use the words hazardous waste and the hazards and indicate the hazards. So the next slide is a simple change, but we think it's important. Until this point, SQGs, so the small quantity generators, at least at the federal level, they only had to notify once. And so what we found is, you know, our data is outdated and inaccurate because there's been no requirement to update that. So, you know, people could have gone out of business or moved, and we don't know. So in the final rule, we are requiring SQGs to re-notify every 4 years, unless the state already has a more frequent re-notification. Electronic reporting will be an option, and because this does affect a lot of generators, we are delaying just this compliance date until 2021. So this gives states time to update their forms, and it's also off cycle with the biennial reporting, so we think that the burden won't be too great. Okay, another kind of more minor change is to drip pads and containment buildings. So we, previously it wasn't clear in the regulations. They were only in the LQG regulations. So it wasn't clear that SQGs could actually accumulate on drip pads and in containment buildings. So it looked like they had to comply with the LQG regulations. We did have an old guidance that made it clear that SQGs could do this on drip pads, and we decided to codify this to make it clear. So now it's clear that SQGs can accumulate on drip pads and in containment buildings, provided they meet the technical standards, so subpart W of 265 for drip pads and subpart CD up to 65 for containment buildings. And then they also need to meet the regular SQG conditions of accumulating, which are in 262.16. Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to Kathy to talk about emergency preparedness and planning.
Thank you. There we go. For emergency planning and preparedness, we made some changes that apply to SQGs and to LQGs to varying degrees. And most of the changes that we made in this area are in place to improve the connections between the generators and their local responders. And then there are some places where we clarified the regulations or added a little bit of flexibility. So in regards to making and documenting arrangements with local emergency responders, the problem was that although the previous regulations required the generators to attempt to make arrangements with the local emergency responders regarding the waste, there was no requirement to document that those arrangements had been made. There was a requirement to document if the local responders declined to enter into arrangements, but not if they accepted and the arrangements were made. So it made it difficult for either party to verify that this had been done. So in the final rule, generators must document that they've attempted to make arrangements and that those arrangements or that the arrangements were sought and weren't obtained. And they have to keep that documentation somewhere in the operating record. There is no specific form or type of documentation that's required. So it can come in any form in the operating record. We're also finalizing a provision that just applies to LQGs in regards to their contingency plan, where they need to put together a quick reference guide of all the most important parts of that contingency plan at the moment of a response. So we talked to first responders about this and to some of the states as we were developing this. And it really, the idea is to make available the information in that contingency plan that is going to help with a response that the responders can look at on the truck on the way to the event. The way that we're putting this into effect is by requiring new LQGs that are submitting contingency plans to also include the quick reference guide, and then to require existing LQGs to include a quick reference guide when they otherwise update their contingency plan. So it's kind of a rolling implementation of this provision. As far as contents of the guide, as I said, it's going to be the most critical information, the names and types of hazardous waste and associated hazards. If you look at this in the regulations, you'll see that this is not asking for a list of waste codes. It's actually much broader than that, broad types of waste, like maybe spent solvents or something to give you an idea of what materials you're handling. Some estimated maximum amounts that will be on site, anything that requires unique or special treatment, a map of where the hazardous waste will be and of the facility, where the water supply can be found, an identification of on-site notification systems, like a PA system that can be used, and then a contact. And we do actively encourage the generators also to continue to work with their emergency authorities to make sure that all the important information is included here. There are a variety of smaller revisions, and I'm not going to go all the way through them. I do want to note that we finalized a clarification that the scope of contingency planning and emergency procedures applies to the areas where hazardous waste are being accumulated. And that includes the SAAs and the CAAs. There was some confusion about you know, some people seem to think that the RCRA regulations were supposed to apply to the whole facility. Other people thought that maybe it applied just at the CAA. So we did put this in the regulations that it's where the hazardous wastes are generated and accumulated. And I'm not gonna, as I said, we don't really have time to go through this, but we are available to answer the questions. Our next provision is a waiver to a requirement that Mary Beth is going to talk about.
Okay, so this just applies to LQGs. There was an existing requirement that containers holding ignitable or reactive waste had to be located at least 50 feet from the property line. And we've heard over the years that this can be hard or impossible to meet, especially in urban areas, where sometimes the properties aren't even 100 feet wide. So we promulgated a provision that allows them, LQGs, to approach the fire marshal to apply for a waiver. And the fire marshal can, you know, give more site-specific precautions that would make the waiver appropriate and safe. So that is a less stringent provision, so states will need to pick it up before someone could use it. Then the next thing we're going to talk about is the biennial reporting changes. These are fairly minor. There were some inconsistency between the data elements that were reported in the regulations and what was included in the instructions to report. And there was also some old guidance about who must report and how much must be reported. And then finally, until this point, we did not necessarily require facilities that don't store prior to recycling to report, and we decided that we needed to fix that. So instead of listing in the regulation specific data elements to be reported, we are now going to just refer generators to the form instructions. This way we don't have to, you know, change the regulations every time the form is updated. Then we've also clarified that LQGs have to report all of the hazardous waste generated and managed on site in the reporting year, even if they weren't an LQG every month. So that is a clarification. It was in the existing guidance, but it was inconsistent in some old Federal Register notice. So we've clarified that's how that should work. And then finally, recycling facilities that don't have a RCRA storage permit now are required to report the hazardous waste being recycled. And that is to close the gap. I mean, most recycling facilities do have RCRA storage permits, but we know there are some that don't, and we didn't think it was, we need to know about those facilities as well. Under the record keeping, we also clarified how tanks, people that, generators that accumulate hazardous waste in tanks should keep records to show that they are getting the waste in the tanks off-site in their either 90 or 180 days. So we've added language to the regulations that allows them to use inventory logs, monitoring equipment, or other records to demonstrate that they're basically turning over that tank every 90 or 180 days. And we included the two, I guess, typical ways is either a batch process or a continuous flow process tank. So we made that clear in the regulations. And those records, we did clarify they have to be kept on site and readily available, but they don't necessarily have to be in close proximity to the tank. Especially if the tanks are outdoors, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. So, and then next slide. We also took comment on a number of other reporting and record keeping provisions, but we did not finalize these at this time. And these mainly because we were told that it was, you know, too much burden and there wasn't enough benefit. One was, the first one was maintaining documentation of your waste generations until the facility closes. You know, some of these facilities have been around for 100 years, so that didn't really make a lot of sense. So it's the we just kept the typical 3-year record-keeping requirement. As I'll talk about in a minute, we are not requiring that you notify the state or EPA if you close a waste accumulation unit. That's one option, but you don't have to. You don't have to notify. And then we also are not requiring documentation of container weekly inspections, although we continue to encourage that as a best management practice. So under closure, the existing program already required that if you were an LQG and you accumulated in tanks, drip heads, or containment buildings, you had to close basically as a landfill if you couldn't clean clothes. But we didn't have a similar requirement for container storage areas. But there were plenty of documented cases where this was a problem and there were damage cases because LQGs abandoned their facility and then required cleanup. And we also had not required until this point that states or EPA be notified when a facility closes. So in the final rule, we are basically putting the same closure standards on LQG container storage areas that already applied to the other storage areas. So basically, they have to, if they can't clean clothes, they're going to have to close the landfill. And then we're requiring, there's two kinds of notification. If you're just closing your accumulation area, then you can put a notice in your operating record within 30 days after closure. Or if you are, you know, sure that you're not going to use that area again and you want to go through the and show that it's clean closed, then you would do that and notify EPA or the state. However, once you're closing the whole facility, then you do have to notify EPA or the state. And you're going to do that twice. You're going to do it at least 30 days before closing. And then once you close, you're going to do it within 90 days, and you're going to certify that you met the closure performance standards. Or if you can't, then you're going to notify that you can't clean clothes. You can request an extension, but you have to do that within 75 days after closing so that EPA or the state knows, and they can come out and do an inspection if they so choose. Okay, now I'm going to turn it back to Kathy. She's going to go over some clarifications and wrap up.
Yeah, we have some final clarifications that were in the rule that we're just going to touch on. One of them is the revisions to 262.10, which are in there to better explain the framework of the regulations in a couple of ways. In one way, you'll see as you look at 262.10 in the final rule, it really operates more like a roadmap for the generators, letting them know, you know, if you're this category of generator, these are all the provisions you need to follow. And then it also more clearly describes the longstanding distinction in the generator regulations between the conditional exemptions from permitting that the generator has versus the independent requirements of making a hazardous waste determination, counting, that kind of thing. So that's something that has long been in the regulations, but it wasn't described fully. So that's what that is what we've done with 262.10. You might be aware that this is the area of the revisions that the lawsuit on this touches on according to the litigant's statement of issues. As I mentioned, this distinction has always existed in RCRA, but we haven't defined it in these kinds of terms before in the regulations. Anything that was in 262.34 in the previous regs, that's a condition for the permitting exemption. And in the reorganized regulations, those are the provisions you're going to find in 262, 14, 15, 16, and 17, as well as the episodic generation provisions in subpart L and the emergency provisions for LQGs in subpart M. This change was spurred, again, in the need to make this framework more clear, and also because of the way we reorganized the regs. It seems to make sense. There are a couple of other clarifications and revisions. Like I touched on, defining some new terms, including the categories of the generators, clarifying that you can't dispose of liquid waste in a landfill, deletion of some obsolete provisions that we're not using anymore but we're still lingering in the regulations, and a whole slew of about 30 technical corrections to the regs, which were typos and that kind of thing, very small changes. But those were all part of this rulemaking. This slide is something that's for your use later if you're thinking about this. It goes through the generator categories and which of the major changes apply to each generator category. And that is for your reference when you're thinking about the rule later. Basically, we've come to the end now, and basically the rule represents what we think was a much needed update to this program after 30 plus years of use by us and the generators and by all of you. We've made some big changes, and some of them are quite small, but together they really touch practically every part of the generator regs. I want to thank you guys for being on the line today. We have a few minutes to take some questions, but we'll do our best to answer them. If you want to reach out to us after the webinar, this is our contact information. We may not be able to get back to you right away, but we are keeping track of the questions as they come in, and we will do our best to answer any questions you have in a timely manner. I guess I am giving this back to Jeff for some questions.
One thing I wanted to quickly mention, I think it's on the overall slide. Our website is also should be on the CLUIN web page. And that has the final rule, of course. It also has, it will have a map of the states that adopt, and we're planning to do some frequently asked questions that we'll put up there. So there'll be some resources online for you as well.
Yeah, and the major changes to our website, to the major pages of our website will go into effect with the rule on May 30th to account for the new definitions and that kind of thing. We will have some trailing revisions that we are working on to some of the documents and a way to address reference stuff in RCRA Online and the FAQs where citations are going to change. We know that's out there. We're working on it, but it probably won't be ready by May 30th. I'm dismayed to announce, but we are working on it.
Thank you, guys. Jeff. So we got, not surprisingly, we did get a lot of questions because we have over 540 people who tuned in. So I will ask questions as many as we have time to ask. We may run over 2 p.m. a bit, just a little bit. So we got a number of questions related to the pending litigation regarding the rule. The basic gist of them is, can you explain the nature of the challenge, the legal challenge, and what is likely to happen pursuant to the challenge?
Well, if anyone can answer Part B of that question, I would love to know what is likely to happen. Unfortunately, we're still pretty early on this. We got the statement of issues at the beginning of last month from the litigants, and their issue, this might have come in before I went over it, but their issue, according to that is a non-binding statement of issues. So there could be other things, but it seems like their main issue is the changes we made to 262.10 regarding the distinction between the conditions for exemption for the permitting, for the generators, and the independent requirements that the generators have to follow. So basically, we did a variety of things in that area. We defined conditions for exemption and independent requirements. We made a distinction between them in 262.10A, and we listed which of each ones each generator has to follow. And then we also made a change to 262.10G that talks about what kind of penalties you're subject to when if you're found in violation of each, you know, either an independent requirement or a condition for exemption. So that is what they pointed to in their statement of issues, saying that it was arbitrary and capricious. And as far as we have gotten, as of last week, we got a briefing schedule from the court. Petitioner's brief is due in June. EPA has 60 days to do our brief due in August, and then they get a response brief due a couple weeks after that. And what happens from there is anybody's guess. So they'll schedule oral arguments, I imagine.
Right, but apparently the D.C. Circuit is quite backed up, so we don't know how long it will take after the brief before we go to oral argument. But
yeah,
we're planning for the rule to go into effect, and we're working on implementation issues.
So the bottom line is that the May 30th date is still the effective date.
Yeah, at this point, the petitioners have not requested a stay in the implementation of the rule, and we are going ahead as planned.
Great, thank you. Next question, on slide 18 focused on hazardous characteristic determinations, what about determinations for listed waste?
Well, actually, it's both. I think that the determination is either listed or characteristic. I think people have had more issues trying to determine if their waste is characteristic or not. There's been more questions, so we put more language in, but it still applies. But most people use generator knowledge to determine if they have a listed waste, because it's just deciding if you meet that listing description, whereas the characteristics can be a little more challenging. So, but the overall 262.11 applies to both.
Okay. The next question, what are residues from the cleanup of an acute hazardous waste? Could you provide an example? It refers to slide 20.
Oh, yeah. So residues of a cleanup of acute waste is a specific category of hazardous waste. Currently discussions of this are in 261.5, I believe. That's where they are. But it doesn't go into any depth. It's just if you spill an acute waste and then you clean it up, that has to be counted as a separate category of waste. So if you had, you know, if it went into soil and you picked up the soil, you can't just, well, yeah, the generator can't just, you know, assume that it's diluted out. They have to actually manage those residues as in this category, which isn't counted like acute waste, but it does have a smaller threshold than non-acute hazardous waste.
And the acute hazardous waste are the P waste. Basically all of them are in the P list. So they're more toxic than regular hazardous waste.
Okay, thanks. We got a few questions about related to slides 23 and 24. The first one is, what is the petition and notification process referred to in slide 23?
So for a petition, this is regarding episodic generation. So the question is about if you have a first event A facility has had one event, and they went through episodic generation for that. Let's say they had a tank clean out early in the year, and they decided to do episodic, and they complied with all the regulations. And then, you know, a hurricane comes through in the fall and causes a spill, and they want to clean that up under episodic generation as well. So the petition for the second event is, there isn't a specific form, although there is a list of information that needs to be sent to the state or the region if you're not authorized. So there's basically a small list of information about the event, you know, what kind of wastes are involved, how much, what caused the event, why they need the second event, that kind of thing. It isn't a specific form, though. I did want to mention that the other notification under episodic generation, so I don't want to confuse things, that's a petition. It's not a specific form. The notification stuff that I talked about during my presentation, that is using the site ID form, and we do have a revised version of that that is in the works, and hopefully will be available by May, although if it's by May 30th, if it's not, we're going to have to think of another solution, but hopefully it will be available and up on our website to be used. If not, we will come up with some kind of guidance for how to use the current form. But that is for standard notification under the episodic event. For the petition, it has to be written, but other than that, there isn't any specific form for it. Sorry, I didn't mean to be overly confusing there, but hopefully sorted out.
Here's another related question. If a generator has two episodic events, are they required to submit biannual report?
No. If you're operating, if you're a VSQG or an SQG doing episodic generation, the biannual report is not required.
Okay. Next question is, there do not appear to be any record-keeping requirements for CESQG. This is problematic when trying to verify a facility's generator status. They can say they are CESQG and not be required to have any documentation to prove it. Do you have any suggestions or comments for this?
Yeah, that federally, that's how it's always worked, and we, you know, we did not change that with this rule. So, you know, if a state inspector or a regional inspector really thinks they're claiming they're what used to be called a CESQG and now we're calling a BSQG, if they're claiming that and they really think they're over, they're going to probably have to schedule a couple inspections, like within a time frame where they can do the counting.
Okay, thanks. Next question. We only have time for two more because, unfortunately, we have to move on out of where we are at right now. Are there any distance limits on the transportation of VSQG waste to a LQG? For instance, a VSQG on the West Coast sending to an LGQ on the East Coast?
There's no specific distance limitations, but this is a less stringent provision. So first, both states will have to pick up the provision. And technically, if it's going through states, as it, like, we call them in-transit states, we suggest that the facility contact those states to see if they're allowed to pass through without a manifest. So if it's really going across the country, that's going to be kind of a limiting factor, I think.
Yeah, and practically I'm not sure that would occur. I mean, I guess depending on the requirements in the state it's coming from. That's a long way to ship waste when federally that waste doesn't have to go otherwise to a TSDF. But I guess it could happen, and yeah, the less stringent requirements in the states. It's going, you know, coming from and going to and going through would have to be considered. Make sure that it's going to apply there.
Okay, and we'll do one more question. I'm sorry we weren't able to answer everybody's question. Regarding Section 262.17A8, would this be applicable to any facility that popped up as an LQG at any time in their history?
Is this closure?
Yes. Closure.
I think it is closure, yes.
Well, I guess that is a question that we don't have an easy answer to. You know, if they were a VSQG or SQG for most of their time and just popped up once in a while, they would have to talk to their state. We do think if they are an LQG most of the time, then they need to notify of closure. So you can't, like, be an LQG for 15 years and then decide you're going to close, so gradually ramp down your operations so that you're a VSQG for the last few months and then say you don't have a... We think the closure obligation continues to apply.
Yeah, it's a case-by-case that would have to be worked out if they're really fluctuating generator. You know, if they were an LQG for a significant amount of time at all, we think that closure is going to apply even if they end their operating life at a smaller category.
Okay, thank you. Again, I apologize for not being able to answer all the questions. There are still questions coming in. So I think I will turn things back over to Jean and thank Jean for hosting this or helping us moderate this event.
Yeah, I just want to jump in. Like, even though we didn't get to your questions, they are useful to us. We do look at them, and they help us determine what kind of guidance we should put out there. So thanks for submitting them.
All right. Thank you so very much. Let me just walk through a few final reminders before we close out today's webinar. First, I wanted to remind everybody that a copy of the presentation materials are currently available to download from the seminar homepage. I've sent everybody a link from the Q&A window, but you can also access it using the related URLs window on the middle right of your screen. Today's session was recorded, so if you happen to be one of those lucky people replaying the recorded version, you can still access the related URLs. Simply click on the link and press the Browse To button to open those links up. One of the most common requests that I get, as mentioned earlier, is contact information for the instructors and organizers. You'll find that on the seminar homepage. But more importantly, is getting a feedback form where you can actually download or print out a participation certificate. So for those of you who would like one of these participation certificates for your own records, if you fill out the online feedback form, there is a box on that form that you can check. It appears near the bottom of it that will essentially allow you to certify you are here for the full session. Once you check that box and submit your feedback, you will then have access to a certificate that looks something like this, and essentially you can save it or print it out. Each person in the webinar can fill out their own feedback form, so if you happen to fill or participate as a group in one location, there are links once you submit one feedback form to have another person hop on and complete their own individual feedback form. If you are watching the recorded version, you can also still click on those links to the feedback form and get your own participation certificate based off of the replay of the live event. So I will ask if you can please send in that feedback and let us know. We do read all of those submissions to help us to continue to offer sessions. I wanted to remind everybody that we are going to carry on with the webinar series. We will have our upcoming RECRA Expert Seminar on June 7th, which will cover post-closure care guidance for hazardous waste facilities. And again, that session is going to look at guidelines for evaluating the post-closure care period for hazardous waste disposal facilities under Subtitle C of RECRA. That session will take place on Wednesday, June 7th at 1 p.m. Eastern. And I'll share the link to register for that event. We do have registration open again today. So this, again, is the conclusion for today's live broadcast. I want to thank everybody for joining us. We will send out a recorded link as soon as it's available so that you can play the seminar back on demand. And I hope